Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. And the speeches you're about to listen to were recorded at DEF CON 6, which was held in July 31st to August 2nd, 1998, at the Plaza Hotel and Casino in Old Downtown Las Vegas. These speeches are copyright, non-commercial use, educational uses only. If you'd like to use them for any other purpose, please contact DEF CON at www.defcon.org or email to dtangent, that's D-T-A-N-G-E-N-T, at defcon.org. Now, some of the speeches were lost, so you're getting what we've got recorded. Now sit back and relax, and here comes some knowledge to your head.
Can you guys hear me? Can you guys hear me now? How about now? No? Okay. First, I'm just going to make a brief announcement, which is that Cult of the Dead Cow is supposed to meet at 2 o'clock outside for their photo shoot. And now on to my speech. I'm Jennifer Granick. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I work in San Francisco. And I'm going to talk about crime today. Okay, this is much better for me. I'm going to talk about crime today. My purpose in this talk was that I intended to be something of a cautionary tale so that people out there would know what other people had done. They could figure out what was illegal and what was not illegal from how other people got in trouble, and also figure out how it was that the people who got in trouble ended up getting caught. And hopefully, the lessons that would be learned from the cases that I'm going to talk about would be, first of all, what's illegal to do, and second of all, in the case where you do happen to get in trouble, how to minimize the problems that you yourself encounter. You can adjust your behavior accordingly. That was the purpose of my speech. And while I was in my office in San Francisco thinking about what I was going to be telling you guys today and wondering what would be a good case to get across my message, the telephone rang. And I picked up the telephone, and it was the FBI. And the FBI wanted to know what I was going to be telling you guys. The FBI wanted to know whether I was going to be telling you guys how not to get caught. Because the FBI thought that if I told you guys how not to get caught, then you would think that it was okay to go out and do crime. We all have the attorney-client privilege here, so feel free. No secrets escape this room. The FBI thought that if I told you how not to get caught, I would be encouraging you to do crime, and that would be very irresponsible of me. So, I don't want anybody going out and doing crimes because Granick said if I didn't do these five things, I wouldn't get caught. And as just a cautionary note in honor of the FBI calling me, I'll pass on something to you that criminals always say to each other, which is that there's 100 different ways you can get caught. And if you can think of 50 of them, you're a genius. With that, let's talk about how not to get caught. I'm hoping to talk for like half an hour so I have time for questions. And I don't have a watch. So if I get near half an hour, somebody can just wave and I'll stop. Okay, the first case I'm going to talk about is Mr. Salgado, also known as Max. A very smart man. So he made some mistakes, which ended up in his getting in trouble. And I don't want, we have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight in figuring out what it was that he did wrong. But this guy's no bozo, so it's a good example, a cautionary tale. What Mr. Salgado did was he exploited some known flaws in ISP's operating system, and he went from what he did was he got into a San Diego ISP. He installed a packet sniffer there, and he was collecting logons. And it wasn't very easy, it wasn't very difficult, particularly for him to do. The ISP sysop was doing some routine maintenance and noticed the packet sniffer there. and tried to start copying the audit logs in order to preserve the evidence of his intrusion. However, Mr. Salgado was logged on at the time that this was happening. So as they were trying to save his tracks, he was erasing his tracks. And that was basically it. That's all that happened. He was collecting people's passwords. And the reason why he was doing this is he was basically going from the San Diego IST, I think it's going from the UCSF, the university system, through the San Diego IST to credit card numbers, and he was collecting credit card numbers. That's how it works. So at the time that this happened, at the end of the day, the San Diego IST had pretty much nothing on Mr. Salgado because he'd erased his track. Very smart. Now he's got a bunch of credit card numbers, so what does he do? He talks about it. He's trying to sell the numbers, right? He's wanting money for it, so he's got to talk about it. So he goes on IRC and he starts bragging about how he did the hack and how he's got all these credit card numbers. Well, that was a bad move because somebody who was gone to IRC, they called the FBI and called the IST that had been hacked and said, you know, this guy who goes by the name of Snack is bragging about the hack. So what did they do? What did the FBI do? They got this guy and they made him a cooperating witness. And FBI calls that CW. And the defense lawyer calls that a snitch. They get the snitch and they enlist his assistance. And the snitch is going to bargain with Mr. Salgado for the snitch is going to bargain with Mr. Salgado for the credit card numbers. So the first thing they do is they set up an initial sale to show that they're going to show his good faith in it. In the buyer. And they're negotiating the sale with encrypted email, encrypted by TCP, I understand. They make the initial sale via email, and the snitch pays Mr. Salgado with an anonymous wire transfer through Western Union. After that initial sale, which proves their trustworthiness, they go for the bigger sale. And the snitch arranges to meet Mr. Salgado in the smoking lounge of the airport at San Francisco International. Does anybody want to guess why that's where they arranged to meet? No, it's not for interstate commerce, although that's a good question. Just the very using of the IST makes it interstate commerce, even though all this happened within the state of California, because the wires are in interstate commerce, even though nothing ever actually left the jurisdiction of California. Yes, the metal detectors. The smoking lounge at San Francisco Airport is past the metal detectors. So for Mr. Salgado to get in there, he can't be armed. It makes it very safe, much safer for the agents if they do it there. It's really a little stroke of genius, I thought, on their part. Mr. Salgado shows up with a CD, encrypted CD-ROM with the credit card numbers on it, encrypted with PGP, which the FBI doesn't know how to break. So what are they going to do? What they did was, you know, the one guy's buying the numbers. He's got to tell the guy who's buying the numbers how to decrypt it. So along with that encrypted CD-ROM, Mr. Salgado has a copy of Mario Puzo's The Last Don. And on the last page of The Last Don, he's underlined certain words. And those words are the password, the passphrase for decrypting the encrypted CD-ROM. So poor Mr. Salgado ends up getting arrested right then and there. It goes on to be charged. What are the things that we learned about this case? Well, one of the things that the FBI says is important about this case is it shows the problem of encryption and anonymity in crime fighting. The thing I think it shows is this is a criminal, it's a computer-type crime, but we use good old-fashioned law enforcement techniques to catch him. How they catch him? With a snitch, is the most basic thing. How they get around the encryption? I mean, basically, they socially engineered it by getting him to disclose the passphrase to the snitch. How'd they get around the anonymity? They knew who he was from the snitch. So if encryption and anonymity in this case really did almost nothing to stop or hinder the FBI from catching Mr. Salgado. Mr. Salgado was then charged with these two sections that I've written on the transparency, 1030, which is your basic hacker unauthorized access law, and 1029, fraud regarding access devices, which was the credit card numbers. Now, one thing I just want to make clear about 1030, since I have the opportunity now, is that 1030 prohibits basic intentional trespass into systems. You don't necessarily have to damage anything or even steal anything in order to be guilty of 1030. Okay? All you have to do is get some information while you're in there. Now, when Mr. Salgado was charged with these crimes, he then ended up having to go and he got a lawyer from the public defender's office and defend himself. One of the big issues that were involved in his case is how do you value what he stole, which was basically his credit card. Now, Salgado never used the credit card. He never cheated anybody out of any money. All he had was this information, which is what the credit card numbers were, and he just wanted to sell it for a couple bucks. Actually, for a relatively low price, I would think, for so many credit cards. I think that the snitch was getting kind of a deal. In deciding how much time Mr. Salgado was then going to receive for this particular caper, they have to figure out what's the value of the property that he stole. And that's kind of difficult when it's just information. What the United States Attorney's Office wanted to do was they wanted to take the average balance or the average credit limit of a credit card, which is something like $2,500, and multiply it by the number of credit card numbers that he had, which was something like 10,000, and then use that as the estimate of what damage he had done. And I can explain this later if people are interested, but in the sentencing guidelines, how much damage you did makes a big, big difference in what your sentence is going to be. That would be something like $250 million in damage size, and you'd be way off the fraud chart at a level like that. Eventually, that's not how they ended up valuing it. I think they did something like $100 per credit card number of the ones that weren't deactivated. And he ended up getting something much less than what he was in danger of getting. But that does give you some idea of the way that the law is trying to deal with these crimes and how there's some things that are sort of unsettled, one of which being the valuation of something which is merely information. Okay, the next case I'm going to talk about is a little bit older. It's from 1994, and it's from 1994, and it's the La Mafia case. I'm going to talk about this because it illustrates a change in the law that I think that people ought to be aware about. Mr. La Mafia used his account at MIT to gain access to the internet. From there, he set up an encrypted bulletin board system, and he encouraged people who were accessing the bulletin board system to upload proprietary software like Microsoft Windows or Microsoft Word or WordPerfect to just upload their copies. Then we transmit them or shift them to another, a second encrypted address, and then encourage people to download those proprietary programs for free, sort of providing a free software service. He tried to keep traffic down on the site because he was afraid that that would draw the attention of the authorities, but with something so great as all this free software, it was pretty much impossible for him to control once the word got out. And the amount of traffic that he encountered drew the attention of the university and the federal authorities. Now, I'm not really sure exactly how they ended up figuring out that it was him, and if somebody is, they can come up and say what the story was there when I'm finished. But what happened to him was he was charged with 18 U.S.C. Section 1343, which is wire fraud, for a scheme to defraud the software companies from royalties stemming from the sale of these programs. So his lawyers challenged that charge on the grounds that this was an extension of the wire fraud law into an area which was really covered by copyright. And the copyright law at that time only criminalized copyright violations for profit. The judge agreed with Mr. La Mafia and dismissed all the charges against him. It was great. And then the United States Congress got involved. And in 1997, they passed the No Electronic Theft Act. This act... Okay, No Electronic Theft Act. That's where it's at. 18 U.S.C. 2319 and 17 U.S.C. 506. It punishes the willful infringement of copyrighted material which is worth at least $1,000, even if the copyright infringer makes no money from it. So that copy of Microsoft Word that I have, if I make a copy of that for my dad and a copy of that for my sister, there I go. I'm a criminal. It's depending upon the value of the material, you can get up to a year in jail or 3 years in jail for your first offense, in federal prison for your first offense. So this changes the law quite a bit and makes some relatively innocuous types of copying also criminal. I'm sorry? The question is, what's innocuous? I thought I just gave an example of what would be innocuous. Like if I made some copies of Microsoft Word, one for me to use in my house instead of using it in my office or something like that. Yes, but two copies of it is going to be 1,000. See what I'm saying? So the copy is worth, like, I think mine was like, I don't know, something like $500. And then if you copy it twice, that's 1,000. Boom, federal prison. It's just that easy. Most of the time it appears that and just from what I see, it seems like the federal government has been kind of concentrating on crimes where... Do you have a question for now? Okay, the question is, how does the punishment relate to if you do multiple backups and distribute the backups to different sites? And if it's not licensed, if the copying isn't licensed, that's copyright infringement, and then depending upon the value of each copy or the value of each license, you just add it up, and if you get to 1,000, federal prison. Okay? All right. So, it seems like in a lot of the cases, the federal government... I'm going to try to take questions later, if that's okay. I'm just really... Okay. In most of the cases, it does seem to be that the federal government does kind of try to target situations where actual fraud or some sort of loss is involved, but that is certainly not always the case. I'm going to talk a little bit about the case of Eugene Kasparetz because I think it's an interesting political scenario. Okay. Mr. Kasparetz was an activist. He was mad at Network Solutions because Network Solutions controlled the internet. And he believed that the unofficial monopoly on the domain name system that Network Solutions had was uncool. He thought that it was a battle between socialism, really, where Network Solutions was the tool of the government and had this monopoly over the domain name system, and the free market, where there would be competing domain name systems from which people could freely choose. That made him angry. Particularly, he didn't like Network Solutions' ownership of the .com hierarchy, which is something that I think probably a lot of people have sympathy with. So what he did was, he exploited a loophole in the DNS software, and he directed the internet traffic from internet to his own website. And he programmed the system. What he did was, I'm not sure, I don't understand exactly how he did, but he programmed the system so that it provided misleading information to people who were trying to access the IP addresses about what that address was. That's basically, he was sending out this misleading information. And so the people who would be trying to reach some IP address would come to Kasparetz's website, and on there he would have, you know, his stuff about why he was, what his purpose was, why he was mad at Network Solutions. And he would also have a link back to internet. So people were misdirected, but not fatally so. He never made any unauthorized entry or intrusion into anybody else's system. All he did was cause the system to send misleading information over the internet. And then he bragged about it. Because that was his point. It was a political hack. He was trying to make a point. And when he bragged about it, they went for him. They had him arrested in Canada, and eventually they extradited him and brought him here to the United States for trial. Now, he was charged with the wire fraud statute. I'm not really sure exactly why, because I don't really see the fraud in it. I see the wire. He's transmitting this misleading information over the wire, but I don't really see the wire fraud. Mr. Kasparetz ended up taking a plea bargain in March of this year, and he received something like probation or 6 months in a federal prison or something like that. But it is an example of how the wire fraud laws can be used in an extremely broad way. even though they failed to catch Mr. LaMafia, and also an example of how even when there's absolutely no financial loss or really no damage whatsoever, you can still be subject to federal prosecution. Boo, that's right. Am I at half an hour yet? Okay. Now I'm going to just talk briefly about some other laws, just that we can cover these. Okay. New trade secret law, 18 U.S.C. section 1831. What this does is it prohibits the sector disclosure of trade secrets. Trade secrets are any information. I could read you the code section, but it's just any information, tangible or intangible, electronic, written, no matter how it's stored, which the owner has taken reasonable measures to keep secret, and where the information derives an independent economic value from the fact that it's not generally known to the public. That's a trade secret. You get access to that, you tell anybody about that, you steal that, you're guilty of this code section, 1831. It's a 15-year felony. That doesn't mean you're going to get 15 years. That means you can get up to 15 years. But that's pretty serious. The question is, how do they value the trade secret? Here we find a similar problem that we had when we were trying to value the credit card numbers. And you may remember the Craig Nedar case, where in that case they said that there was this proprietary secret information. It had taken them however many years to create. They had used this many scientists and paid them that much, and their R&D costs, their research and development costs, were something like $3 million. So the value of the information that he had stolen was $3 million. That's how they decided to determine it. Thereafter, Mr. Nedar's lawyer showed that this particular information he had taken was available to employees and others in a booklet for which the phone company charged $13. And since there had to be a showing that the fraud or what the property was valued at was something over some certain level, I think it was $1,000 or $5,000, the charges against him ended up getting dismissed. So there you can see a good example of exactly how difficult it can be to value information. The next statute that I want to just draw your attention to is the Electronic Privacy Act, which is the wiretap statute. The wiretap statute doesn't just authorize federal agents to do wiretaps, it also criminalizes unauthorized wiretaps. So an unauthorized interception of something that's an electronic or a wire or oral communication, like a phone call or email, is a criminal offense. That's a 5 or 10 year felony, depending upon what you've intercepted and for what purpose and how bad you've been in the past. The question is, does it include scanners? And the answer is yes, it includes cell phone scanning. The statute includes cell phone scanning. And finally, the stored communications. Stored communications are like when the email is on the server, or in somebody's account, is just stored there. It's not being transmitted. It's not in transmission. And 18 U.S.C. 2701 criminalizes the access or altering of stored communications. So what kinds of things does this mean may also be illegal? Keystroke monitoring, which intercepts the content of what the person is typing, is possibly criminal under the Electronic Privacy Act. Eavesdropping on cell phones and other communications, not just on a cell phone, but also on a cordless phone, if you intercept the communication between the phone and the base, that is criminalized by the Electronic Privacy Act. What about a packet sniffer? Is a packet sniffer intercepting something that's a communication? I think arguably yes, that could also be a violation of the Electronic Privacy Act. The question is, how much time am I going to get if I use a packet sniffer? Answer, I don't know. I can tell you where the way that the federal sentencing guidelines work is somewhat complicated. You figure out what the crime is and how many years you can get, and then you go up or down depending upon a variety of circumstances related to the crime. Then I'll draw the matrix for you later, but then they figure out how much trouble you've been in the past. They just connect the dots to make the two lines meet on the graph, and whatever it says there, that's what you get. I'll show it to you what it looks like in a bit. So, okay, the question is about personal versus business communications under the Wiretap Act. And this is an important thing. There is a very broad exception to the wiretap rules, which is for business-related communication. And the business is permitted to, a business is permitted to intercept communications which are on its phone system, which relate to the reasonable business purpose of the company or of your boss. So, for example, a lot of times, you know, you call or a credit card company will call you or you'll call them, and they'll say, this call is monitored for quality assurance. They're telling you that because you're the person who calls in. But for their employee, who's the one who you're talking to, they're allowed to monitor all their business calls for whatever reason they might have, as long as it's reasonably related to their business purpose. And they may also have some ability to monitor calls that are not necessarily business-related, but to see if they're business-related to make sure that they're... What they'll argue is, you know, and many of you probably may work for places like this where they say, your computer, our network, our telephone system are owned by the company. Only company business is permitted on the system. So what they'll say then is that when they're monitoring your calls, they're trying to make sure that you're not committing fraud by using the phone system or the computer system for your own personal purposes. That's sort of an extreme way that your employer can get around the dictates of the Electronic Privacy Act. But they can also monitor you in a less ubiquitous way, but still, as long as it's reasonably related to the business. Dave, is that what you wanted me to get at? Okay, thank you. Do you want to ask it now? If it's not business-related and if they're monitoring and it's not business-related, they find out something personal, they're supposed to minimize, which means they're not supposed to listen. Once they realize it's personal, they're supposed to stop listening. If they continue to listen, then there's penalties associated with that. So what does this all mean? The question is, who did they target? Who does law enforcement target, the recipient of the wiretap or the person who set it up? So, for example, you get information from an illegal wiretap. Will they target you? That's a good question. I was going to say preliminarily, yes, but after my talk, we can look it up in the statute book and see if that's specifically something that's prohibited as expected is. Okay, so what does it all mean? Some of these laws are relatively new. Some of these laws are not new, but they're being used in kind of new ways. And there's a lot of questions about what's illegal and what's not illegal that remain unanswered. So if you really want to make sure that you never get in trouble. Well, if you don't want to get in trouble, don't break the law. If you really want to make sure that you never get in trouble, then there's a whole realm of things that are in that gray area where you're not really sure, is what I'm doing illegal or is it not illegal? And that's sort of my purpose in this talk, is to show you how some things you might think are kind of cool, like what cash arrest did, are actually something that can get you into serious trouble. If you're doing something that's kind of shady or suspicious, you can draw the attention of law enforcement. And if you draw the attention of law enforcement and they don't like what you're doing, they may go for you. And if they go for you, a lot of these statutes are vague enough and broad enough that they can put what you did, they can describe what you did in terms of the statute and say that it was criminalized. I mean, a perfect example of this, I think, is the Bernie S. case, where he's in possession of some stuff, basically to buy it at Radio Shack, and mere possession of these things that you had is not criminalized. Your possession of that stuff is okay. which you're not allowed to do, is you're not allowed to possess things which are capable of cloning cellular phones with the intent to defraud. And how did they prove his intent to defraud? Because they never proved that he actually did anything with the equipment that he had. They proved his intent to defraud in two ways, or they argued his intent to defraud in two ways. One, the equipment that he had was basically susceptible to pretty much only one use. So they said, well, why would he have the stuff if he wasn't intending to use it for that one bad use? And second, they looked at the books he had, and the things that he read, and the stuff that was in his apartment, and they said, well, you know, if he's not interested in cellular phone hacking, how come he has the cellular hacker's Bible? How come he has this? How come he has that? And that's how they proved his intent to defraud. So if you have any questions about the thing, so if you're thinking of doing something and you want to know, is it going to come under the criminal law, you might want to ask the lawyer before you go ahead and do it. And there's some questions that they're all taking. Yes? Take him away. They're getting a search warrant for your house right now, man. No, I understand. You know, I understand. Hey, I'm a defense attorney, right? I'm just a messenger here. But what I'm telling. No, no. Well, what they do is they're saying, you know, that they, some, and especially in the realm of computers, people fear knowledge, you know, what they're afraid of is they're afraid of knowledge. They think if you've got the knowledge and you've got the ability and you've got the tools, that's enough to make you a threat. That's what it is. So that's what they're, right, I'm cringing too. So that's what you have to be concerned about, and I understand what you're saying. I mean, you can be interested in reading about a lot of things, but that doesn't mean that you're really doing anything wrong. You're absolutely right. But it's just, you know, in the Bernie S. case, the evidence conspired to make it very difficult for him to argue that he was just in mere possession and never, you know, that there was no risk to him if he went to a jury trial of the jury believing that the reason why he had this stuff was for a bad purpose. Does that answer your question? Okay. Okay, so you want me to take that question now, or?
Do you still have stuff to talk about?
Yeah, I'm just going to talk a little more, and then we'll go for questions. Okay, so you disregard the advice of the FBI, and you didn't get enough lessons out of what I said, and you didn't consult the lawyer first, and you get in trouble. The cops come to your door. What are you going to do? Now, the FBI wanted me to tell you that when Mr. Salgado was caught, he talked. And that it was good for Mr. Salgado that he talked. That's bullshit. I like to say that there's three things you need to know when the cops come and talk to you. The first is just say no. Don't talk to cops. And I can get into this a little more later, but there's never any good reason to talk to cops. If you're going to cooperate, you're going to cooperate after consulting with your lawyer and cutting a deal. There's never any reason to give them information for free. So just say no. The second thing I like to say is that police are like vampires. You know how when a vampire comes to your house, once you let them in, they have free reign? Never let them in your house. Never let them in your car. Once you consent to a search, the rest of it's fair game. And the third thing I like to say, which doesn't really apply so much in this field, but may apply for other things, is whatever you've got in your hand, don't throw it in the bushes. I've seen so many cases where somebody's got something they don't want the cops to see, and the cops are chasing them, and they throw it in the bushes. Well, now it's in plain view. It's much, much easier if you just keep the stuff on you. If they don't have the right to be chasing you, and they don't have the right to be searching you, your lawyer's going to be able to suppress that evidence later. If you throw it in the bushes, you're screwed. Okay. I just want to reemphasize about cooperating with the police. Police are trained in interrogation, and they understand the law, and they know what they're looking for. So you may think that you're going to be able to talk them out of arresting you, or you may think that you're going to be able to convince them to let you go. But once they look like they're going to arrest you, it's just too late. I'm sure I'm going to have questions about this, so I'm not going to go into that too much. And then I just want to point out these other two things. Don't resist arrest. Resisting arrest is illegal. Okay? Just go along quietly. Ask for your lawyer. Don't say anything. That's all you need to know. And then number six, keep your hands visible at all times. When you're dealing with police officers and they're arresting you, a lot of times, if you know, they're putting themselves in a really dangerous situation. They don't know you. They don't know what you got on you. They don't know what kind of person you are. So when they come and they approach you, they're nervous and they're scared that you might do something. And the worst thing that you want to deal with is a scared cop. You want to keep them calm because that keeps you safe. So if you keep your hands visible and you don't do anything that seems aggressive or bad, you're really minimizing the chance that you're going to get the shit beat out of you. A corollary of that, of course, is if you get pulled over, don't go jumping out of the car. You know what I'm saying? If you get pulled over, you just sit in the car, keep your hands on the steering wheel. When I get pulled over, I never go rummaging through the glove compartment right away. They might think I'm going for a gun or something, right? When they want to see my license or registration, I can look for it in front of them, and then they'll know that I'm just, you know, a nice, peaceable girl, and there's no reason to give me a ticket. So keep yourself safe by keeping the cop calm, and keep yourself safe by not telling them anything that they're going to use against you later. And that's it. I'm going to take questions now. The question is, what are the cops allowed to do that we think that they're not allowed to do? Probably a lot of things. I mean, if you got in trouble and you told your attorney what the cops did, we would have some idea. But I mean, the basic stuff, you know, they can't search you. The basic thing that comes up is they can't force you to talk, and they can't search you they can stop you and detain you with reasonable suspicion, but they can't do a full search without probable cause and a warrant unless one of the warrant exceptions applies. I mean, really, you know, it can get pretty complicated, but that's the basic rule. The question is, what's probable cause? Probable cause is that it's more likely than not that a crime is being committed, or a crime has been committed, or a crime is in the process of being committed, and that you are the person who is the committer of the crime. That's probable cause. Probable cause is an objective standard. It does not require that the officer subjectively believe it. The officer can know that the real reason he's pulling you over is because he thinks that you have pot in the car. And there's no real reason for him to think that, except that you're driving like this VW bus and you have long hair and a big Grateful Dead sticker on the back, which is not probable cause yet. But that's why he pulls you over. And he knows that. He knows that's bullshit. He says it's for, you know, some other reason. If for some reason something happens, but it would be something that the officer would have known at the time that contributes to objective probable cause, it doesn't matter what the officer's intent was. Does that make sense? And if they find a trunk full of cell phones, then you're going the way of Bernie. Okay. Is that there? The question is there anything that defines what a reasonable protective measure is in the case of the Trade Secrets Act? And I am not familiar with any, but there may have been. But I'm not familiar with anything in particular as to what would be reasonable. I would suspect that reasonable would be established by whatever the industry standard was. For example, if the company could show this is how other companies try to keep their trade secret, that would be good enough. Wait, I think. The question is, when can an officer search your car? And a car is sort of like a mobile invitation to search me. You don't have the same reasonable expectation of privacy in your car as you have in your house or in yourself. So when you're in a car, it's much, much easier for the officer to pull you over. They can pull you over for the slightest thing, and once they pull you over, whatever they see can help them search your car. There's different rules for your trunk versus the passenger compartment. There's different rules for a box in the passenger compartment versus a box in your trunk versus a box that I'm carrying down the street to my car. So it's kind of a complicated question for me to answer right away, but just to know that when you're in your car, that's one of the less safe places you can be or put things. just because of the mobile nature of it. They say that there's it has extra reasons why a search without a warrant or probable cause would be okay. That's an excellent question. The question is, what if I only make one copy, but other people are making copies? Like, there's a bunch of copies being made of the same thing, but I only have one copy or make one copy. And the answer is, we don't know. It hasn't been applied in that framework yet, so we just don't know the answer to that yet. The question is, what if I just provide the means by which other people can trade wares, but I myself am not a wares trader? It's illegal. I mean, that's what LaMafia was doing. He wasn't trading. He was just providing the place. And this statute, the 1997 statute, criminalizes that. I'm not that familiar with it. Is there a particular... I'm not that familiar with it. Sorry. Yes, you can be defended by that. That's one of the things that they talk about a lot in the civil context, even, is downstream liability, where some hacker comes in through another third party and invades your system, and you want to sue, but you can't sue the hacker because he doesn't have any money, so who are you going to sue? You're going to sue the people whose system you came through because their system was the one that was easy to hack. You understand what I'm saying? Do you have a trusted relationship with your system, has a trusted relationship with this third system? Somebody hacks into it, that third party is now can be in trouble in civil law. Sure, if you can. You know, but that's going to be difficult now that you asked that question.
Repeat the question.
The question was, he said was, all I have to do then to run a ware site is make it look unintentional, and then said that would be difficult now that you've asked that question. The difference, and that's the thing, is that, you know, you're getting in trouble for stuff in this context that you wouldn't necessarily get in trouble with otherwise. In that situation, you are not going to get in trouble.
I have a graffiti wall
on my bulletin board. Well, in this case, what you have, what I think would apply is there's a statutory immunity under the CDA, you know, the Communications Decency Act prohibited indecency on the Internet. And then it was struck down, but one really kind of good thing remained. And it's a statutory immunity, which is that a provider of an electronic communication, your graffiti wall on your bulletin board system would be, it's a very broad definition, the provider of the electronic service or communication cannot be liable under civil law for content which is posted by a third party, okay? So what this does is, like, when AOL has on its site the defamation that Matt Drudge wrote about Sidney Blumenthal, AOL is not in trouble for it because AOL didn't provide the content. So you have the statutory immunity in civil law, and I think you can argue, although it specifically says civil law, I think it would be very easy to argue that if you can't get sued for it in civil law, you can't go to prison for it in the criminal law. My email? jgranick@bnai.com. jgranick@bnai.com. The statutory immunity I talked about is overrides because it's statutory immunity created by Congress. It overrides the Prodigy and the Zarin versus AOL case and the No. You don't have to worry about whether you're monitoring the content as long as you're not the content provider yourself. And the reason why they did that is because Congress didn't want to dissuade ISPs or bulletin board systems like AOL from doing any kind of editing on the or control of the content by the fear that then they would therefore be liable for the defamation. Cobb asks him to look at his backpack because he doesn't like the way he looks. Sure, he can do that. And then what are you going to do?
No.
Right. Just say no. You got it. Okay, so he's asking whether when you obtain proprietary information, how does that impinge upon the freedom of the press? And, you know, the stuff is stolen, but you can still publish it, right? But look what happened in that Chiquita case really recently. Some guy who's a reporter in Ohio steals voicemail off of Chiquita Banana Company's voicemail system. He writes a story about how Chiquita is bribing officials in other countries to help its business down there. Pretty serious stuff, right? But then what happens is they find out he stole it off the voicemail system. He gets fired, the paper retracts it, the paper pays millions of dollars to Chiquita, and Chiquita declares victory in the situation. They're still bribing officials down there in these other countries, but it's hidden behind the fact that people are mad that the voicemails were stolen. Okay, did you want to follow up on that? It's not illegal, but I think, you know, it's a little more complicated. And I'm just saying, you know, there's ways that it can be illegal that you want to be careful. Like, you may remember also ABC got sued because they had people posing as employees who went into Food Lion supermarkets with hidden cameras to show how they were really handling food in an unsanitary way. And they got sued. They didn't have to. First Amendment defense didn't work for them, and they ended up getting a jury verdict against them for a substantial sum of money. So it's a complicated issue. I, of course, think that that should be prohibited by the First Amendment, and the appeals aren't over yet, so we're going to have to see. It's not illegal to just confront somebody and say on camera, hey, man, you did this, what do you think about it? Like 2020 does. That's not illegal because, you know, there's no fact there. I'll take you next. Is that okay? Yes. No, that I know. I said white shirt, and that is you too. You there in the shirt? You're next. I don't know because I'm not familiar with that, but I would say whatever the rest of the industry does is probably going to be okay. Like, for example, in lawyers, you know, email is not necessarily all that secure, but our code of ethics doesn't require us to encrypt our email with our clients just because encryption is still too hard for lawyers to figure out. When it becomes easier, it'll become the standard, but right now it's not, so... We're talking about what would be a reasonable effort to protect the trade secret information, and the answer is I don't know. We don't know. The other white-shirted gentleman. The question is, in the event that you refuse a personal search, can you be detained while they go out and they get a warrant? So is it easier for you to just, you know, wait for the warrant to come? If they have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to detain you, but they don't have the probable cause for the rest of the search, you know, I don't, I'm trying to imagine a situation in which that might happen. You can, if they have reasonable, if they have cause to detain you, you can be detained until you, they get a warrant. But wouldn't you rather have the judge decide that than you decide right there whether they have probable cause? Because here's what they'll do, right? They come to your door and they knock on the door and they want to come in. And you say, no, I'm not going to let you come in. And they say, well, we're just going to come back later with a warrant. And then you say, okay. And then when they come back with a warrant, if they have a warrant, then you get a chance to look at the warrant, you know why they're there, and a judge may look at the reason why they want to come in your house and say no. There's never any reason for you to consent. If they have cause to come in, they'll come in without your consent. If you get arrested falsely, you can sue, although if your damages aren't great, you're going to have a hard time getting... If they take you in, you're arrested. Okay?
Yeah. Was there anything else the FBI suggested
you
not talk about?
I'm not at liberty to disclose that. No, there's nothing else. There's nothing else that they told me that I didn't want to... You know, really, I guess he thought that the message I might be providing was an irresponsible one. And I thought it was nice that he took the time to, you know, bother to call me and talk about it. But there wasn't anything else particular. There wasn't anything he told me not to say, but I just wanted to let you know what his particular special FBI concerns were.
Are you not effectively under arrest at that point?
Can I hear that again?
If you are detained and you don't feel free to go, are you not effectively under arrest at that point?
Okay, here's the definitions of a detention as opposed to arrest, okay? Detention means you're not free to go. An arrest means that your personal liberty is restrained in such a way as would normally be associated with an arrest. Okay? So if you're not free to go, you're detained. And you can always ask, am I free to go? And if you are free to go, then you can just go. Right? If you're arrested, usually it means, you know, you've got handcuffs on, they take you down to the station, that kind of thing. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, but I don't know if it doesn't answer my question, but... The time limit on detention is it has to be reasonable. Isn't it flat, sir?
Is it against the law to access a computer system in an area that they don't want you to access, but they leave it up to, let's say, anonymous access? Because I come across that a lot, where something's anonymous access into some place where you know they don't want you to go, but they've just become secure.
You have anonymous access. Here's what the access rule, I'm not sure I exactly understand the circumstance, but here's what the access rule is. So the question is, if it's just a difficult place to get to, but once you get there, there's sort of unlimited access, is that a defense?
If they allow total access to that area, like world readable, but you just happen to stumble across it, and they give you those privileges, it's against the law.
Okay. I'm going to say I don't know, but I think that would be a good defense. Okay, I think that would be a good sense. The access rule is that there's unauthorized access, which means you're not allowed to be there, or where unauthorized access also can mean you're allowed to be there, but you extend your privilege to be there beyond what you were initially permitted to do. Now, if they're, you know, if it's something like they intend for there's public access because there's nothing that stops public access, but it's just an obscure place to be, I would say that that's a defense. But the answer is, I don't know. Oh, yeah, if there's national security implications or if you use that to steal something, you know, then I think you're definitely in trouble. And you're going to be looking at federal prison. But otherwise, I think that it might be something you could use as a valid defense. Thank you, Dave. And Richard? Okay, so you stop by the police and you assert your rights, and then they threaten you and say that they're going to do something to you. I had this argument with somebody the other day, and they said, well, you know, if I'm innocent and I know I don't have anything in my car, I might as well just let them search it and then move on, as opposed to, you know, take the risk that they're going to get really pissed off at me. I disagree with that. I think that's bullshit. But, you know, They're not allowed to threaten you or harm you. What are they going to do to you? Beat you up? Right, they can threaten to harm you, and then they can either harm you, or they can, or you can let them search, and they can plant something in your car. I mean, I wouldn't want to facilitate it in any way. You know what I'm saying? You're obviously dealing with somebody who's really problematic, and agreeing to let them search isn't going to help you any either. But I understand your concern. And like I said, you know, reasonable people have differed with me on this particular thing, but I think you just got to know your rights and assert your rights. The other thing is, the more often people assert their rights, the less guilty asserting your rights appears to look, right? So some people have argued that when you attempt to encrypt information, some people argue that when you attempt to encrypt information, that's a sign that the information that you're trying to transmit is contains something that is incriminating. The more people who use encryption for innocent communications, the less guilty encryption is going to look, and the better off we're all going to be.